This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for the Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It was a long primary night for some candidates. The GOP races for governor and first congressional district weren't settled until Wednesday. GOP gubernatorial nominee Chris Sununu claimed that was all part of the fun.
But you got to count all the votes. It's part of the New Hampshire way. It wouldn't be a good New Hampshire primary if it wasn't close and exciting for everyone.
And with all those primary votes counted, the focus turns to November. Here's Jeff Woodburn, Democratic leader of the New Hampshire Senate, rallying members of his party yesterday.
Don't underestimate the strength of those Republicans. We're going to beat them, and we're going to win, and we're going to change New Hampshire.
And the candidates who occupy the very highest rungs of the ballot were here yesterday also. GOP nominee Donald Trump campaigned in Laconia. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine visited the Seacoast. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this morning by Kathleen Rodin, Associated Press, Casey McDermott, NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, everybody. Let's talk about the primary. Why don't we start with the governor's race? On the GOP side, it was expected to be competitive. It was, with Chris Sununu winning, but State Rep Frank Edelblue came awfully close, about 1,000 votes from winning. I'll start with you, Kathleen. Did you see that result coming, and what do you think it means?
I would say that, I thought it was going to come down to Gatsis and Sununu, but I wasn't overly surprised to see that Frank made a strong showing. Going into the primary, I think there was a point maybe in the summer where I thought that maybe he would do well. He was really exploring this and working hard on this before anyone else was. Back since last summer, he was showing up at presidential primary events, handing out his business cards, talking to voters. So he'd been working this for a long time. And I think that it shows, he was really able to capture a certain segment of the Republican Party, more conservatives, as well as the more libertarian-leaning Republicans. He had a huge share of Republican state reps that were backing him, the people that you would consider, the most hardcore of Republicans in the state house were with Frank. And so I think that in a relatively low turnout primary, I don't think it's all that surprising that he was able to do as well as he did. I think that, I talked to some of his supporters yesterday who were saying that they think, it shows that conservatives want to make sure that their voices are heard and that they do think that Chris Sununu has a little bit of work to do with those conservatives, particularly over Planned Parenthood. But all the Edelblue supporters that I talked to said that they would vote for Chris because they think it's really important to have a Republican, at least the state reps. They said, we can't deal anymore with passing what we see as good legislation and having a Democratic governor veto it. So surprising, I guess it was more surprising to me that Gatsis did as poorly as he did than that Frank did as well as he did.
So, Dean, obviously you had four candidates, turnout that was lower than what Secretary of State Bill Gardner projected. His projection was 126,000 Republicans would vote. About 110,000 Republicans voted in the GOP primary. You have a bunch of candidates splitting up the vote. Edelblue sticking to his guns, galvanizing conservatives. Chris Sununu got in this race early with the thought of, maybe he could kind of scare people out. That didn't happen. What's your take on the results here?
Sure. It is true, as Kathleen was saying, that so much of the campaign discourse and narrative throughout the summer and into the fall really has been about Gatsis and Sununu kind of mixing it up on comments that Sununu had made about Manchester, comments back and forth about the opioid crisis, challenging Sununu on his support of Planned Parenthood. So I think a lot of people thought going into this that it was going to come down to Sununu and Gatsis, and I think it was a little surprising that, you know, once we got outside of Manchester, Gatsis didn't quite have the support that he really needed to be competitive. And Edelblue, who a lot of people don't really know, kind of flew under the radar, stuck to conservative themes on, gun rights, socially conservative on abortion, his right to life. I think what this really mirrors is an underlying split in the Republican Party. We're seeing it at the national level. We're seeing it locally. Conservatives want a conservative. And there was some concern that Chris Sununu was kind of getting ahead of himself and sort of running a general election campaign in the primaries because he believes that's what he'll need to do to go up against, as we now know, Colin Van Oostrom. It's interesting. I've talked to a few Republican voters yesterday anecdotally, and they all said to me, yeah, you know, Chris Sununu is fine, but I don't really know much about him beyond the fact that he's a Sununu. So he still has some work to do. But certainly on the Democratic side, Colin Van Oostrom, for as commanding as his victory was among Democrats, most of the data shows that he's not particularly well known either. So they got a lot of ground to cover just in the next 50 some odd days in order to get voters familiar with where they want to take the state.
Well, why don't we take a listen to something Chris Sununu said at the GOP Unity Breakfast on Wednesday morning, talking about the approach he brought to this campaign.
I began running a general election in September of last year, to be honest about it. This is all about winning in November. That's what it is. It's not that I ignored the primary by any means, but it's about making sure that our message last September is the exact same message it is yesterday, today, and all the way through November. You can't start wavering and pandering and doing all that kind of stuff like the Democrats do. We've run a consistent message, a great race. I take great pride in the votes I've cast with my constituents in mind every single time. That's what the people of New Hampshire want. They want a governor that's going to cast a vote for the constituents, no matter what the personal or political outcome may be to the individual.
Okay, that was Chris Sununu at the Unity Breakfast. Now, you know, he talked about running a general election from the very start and not wavering. You know, you took a look at Frank Edelblue's record, Casey, and that's one where his supporters say that, you know, you can demonstrate that he hasn't wavered on issues that really ran the gamut for conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, he's a first-term state rep, so he has a relatively short political record in terms of voting and legislation that he's introduced. But in the time that he has been in the legislature, he's really kind of packed a conservative punch into that record. Sponsored, a number of bills that really kind of echo the themes that we heard throughout his campaign. As Dean said, you know, gun rights, socially conservative issues, issues around kind of charter schools, property owners' rights. These are all things that we heard him talk about on the campaign trail. And it was interesting, too, just to kind of go back to something that Kathleen said in terms of his ability to kind of, you know, appeal to the, you know, conservative base in New Hampshire. He, I think, was able to do that from a lot of different angles. And in some ways, he kind of reminded me of like the Ted Cruz of this gubernatorial race, in that he was able to both appeal to the kind of, you know, core conservatives, like very right-leaning social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, but also had a little bit of kind of a libertarian tinge to the message that he brought. And when I talked to him about a month ago, just kind of asked him, like, listen, it looks like you guys are getting a lot of kind of grassroots support among conservatives. He kind of stopped me and was like, well, you know, it's not just conservatives. Like, we're trying to appeal to a broad segment of Republican voters. And he pointed it out, too, that he was actually endorsed by the Marijuana Policy Project. And he said, you know, look, they also endorsed liberal Democrat Steve Marchand. So this is an example of an issue in which, like, I'm very liberty oriented. I'm trying to bring a lot of different folks into this campaign.
Well, it was interesting to watch him at the Republican Unity Breakfast. And, you know, you did get the sense that, you know, he had arrived in a way with this result. People from across the spectrum and of varying degrees of purported importance over there sort of clapping him on the back. And, a lot of supporters at his campaign headquarters on election night, a lot of them were sort of, you know, making a show that, like, they were at that point, they didn't know that he had lost, but they were going to pack away these signs and, you know, save them for another go round. And, you know, you mentioned you compare him to Ted Cruz. I mean, one thing that Frank Edelblue did that I thought was effective for him was, you know, he kept things positive by and large. I mean, he criticized the other candidates somewhat, but I mean, I do think he may have been the beneficiary of some of the ugliness you saw between Gatsa, Sununu, and Forrester, and he was able to keep things positive, and sometimes that can be helpful.
Yeah, Kathleen? And I think that he was also very articulate. You knew exactly what he wanted to do, what he was going to do. He presented very well. And I think for voters that may have been, tuning in just to a debate, trying to make their decisions there. Again, because he was not in the fray of arguing with the others and because he was very clear about what he wanted to do, I think that people liked that. And a lot of his supporters told me that they found him to be someone that was very honest and very open and very clear about the policies that he was going to pursue. And I'm not, you know, saying that the other candidates weren't, but people who have been in politics a little bit longer tend to be speaking, I think, platitudes a little bit more than, you know, Frank did.
Okay, let's turn to the Democrats. This race turned out to be easily won by Executive Counselor Colin Van Ostern. He faced Steve Marchand, former Portsmouth mayor, and Mark Connolly, former state securities regulator. Van Ostern has a background in campaigns. He's also worked at Stonyfield Farms and Southern New Hampshire University. I think people expected him, close to politics, expected him to run the more kind of professional campaign based on his background. He certainly had the resources. You know, he won pretty easily. Does that tell us anything about, you know, his ability to translate outside the party, you know, in a few weeks? I mean, obviously, he's the seat he's held is, you know, an executive council district that is gerrymandered to elect Democrats. So he hasn't really faced voters, you know, in a when the outcome was really much in doubt. Although this primary, you know, Marchand and Connolly had their moments. What do you think, Dean?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, and Steve Marchand, someone who actually I don't believe ran any television ads in the race, still managed to get 25% and finish second. You know, I think what it demonstrates is that Van Ostern has clearly laid the groundwork within the party, among party regulars. He had the strongest organization, the most money, the most sort of big name endorsements. I think we've talked about this before. He tried very hard to kind of lay this out as though he's sort of the next logical governor, you know, Shaheen, Lynch, Hassan, and now Van Ostern. You know, he's going to have some work to do, though, I think, to getting known to the larger population. At that Unity breakfast, was it just yesterday, you know, he laid out very sort of typical progressive themes. He talked about Planned Parenthood. He talked about commuter rail, which is a big thing for him. And he talked about Medicaid expansion. So, you know, those are sort of popular progressive themes. I think he's off to a good start within the party. But they should be a little concerned that the recent Granite State poll data showed that he's sort of still fairly unknown. But I think they'll have enough money to get ads out there and they'll try to turn it around.
So why don't we take a listen to what Colin Van Ostern said to state Democrats yesterday morning at the Unity breakfast.
And if you elect me as your governor in November, I will spend every day as your governor focused on good jobs and good schools and good access to health care, on overcoming the opioid crisis and always protecting a woman's health. And we will do it with no sales tax and no income tax.
Okay, Colin Van Ostern speaking to state Democrats at the party's Unity breakfast. No income tax, no sales tax. We hear that from Democrats running for governor a lot. Casey, you were at these Unity breakfast yesterday. Did you get the sense that people are excited that he's the nominee?
Yeah. So actually, I think that clip was from his victory rally the night before. But regardless, he echoed a lot of the same themes and he kind of had standard stump speech that he used at both of them. I think that, you know, the sense that I get is that Democrats are comfortable. He's kind of a safe pick. He doesn't rock the boat too much. He has, you know, a few initiatives that are like, you know, more progressive in terms of really pushing hard for commuter rail, really pushing hard for full day kindergarten. These are things that really, I think, play into a lot of aspirations that the Democrats have here in New Hampshire. But, you know, that key phrase that he has in there, and kind of really gets at his like brand as a candidate is, you know, and we will do it with no sales and no income tax. That's really the kind of pragmatic, mainstream, Democratic position that we've heard from Lynch, from Shaheen, from Hassan. So
I mean, we've never heard anything different from a Democrat who's won a general election.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's fair to say that he's the safe pick for Democrats this year in terms of their, you know, the nominee that they would be putting up.
I mean, one thing that will be interesting for voters is, you know, and if you're looking at the political records of Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ostern, is that you have to divine it from their work on the Executive Council, where, you know, with the exception of some issues such as Planned Parenthood, a lot of it is, you know, contracts that are about one vendor versus another, and, you know, maybe appointments can become a little politically heated at times. But, you know, that's one thing that, and, you know, most of the time the counselors from both parties agree with the person setting the agenda, who is the governor. We actually have a caller, I believe, on the line, Scott, who may have a question on the council. Scott, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
So, like you said, both Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ulster are on the executive council. And Chris Sununu made a comment Tuesday night that Colin Van Ulster is a rubber stamp, basically, for Maggie Hassan on the executive council. And I was just wondering, what is Chris Sununu's record in voting with Maggie Hassan?
Good point, Scott. By and large, you know, the way the council works is the governor sets the agenda, and so to get on the agenda, the governor has to put an item there. You know, most of the time, counselors agree. Sununu has dissented from Governor Hassan to a greater degree than Colin Van Ostern has, but you could certainly say that by and large, all the counselors vote for the governor. It's not a body where you've got a counselor voting no, no, no on everything. Kathleen?
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that, you know, it's not the executive council's job to make policy decisions. It's the legislature's job to make policy decisions, and it's really the council's job to evaluate these contracts that come in to implement these policy decisions. So they certainly make it about policy. I mean, we've seen it become very political on issues such as funding studies for commuter rail, funding for Planned Parenthood, contracts that will implement Medicaid expansion and other things like that. But you know, inherently, it's not a policy-making body. And so I think that's why you see, you know, that's why you see them voting, you know, on 5-0 a lot on a lot of things. And I think that it's going to be interesting to watch the two of them kind of, you know, they say they don't want to make the council political, but when that's the only office that you've served on, we're going to hear all of these various council votes, I think, very politicized in the next few meetings that they're going to be having. But it really is an interesting and obviously unique body to New Hampshire, and to have two executive counselors running against each other is going to make for, I think, a unique race.
Well, as a springboard for higher office, it's not you know, most people's chosen leaping off point. I mean, you can look back to Judd Gregg, went from the council to Congress, and of course to governor and U.S. senator. You've had other people who have sat on the council run for governor, but you know, it hasn't been the obvious leaping off point. But, you know, to Kathleen's point, in some ways, it's a place where one can go get their name known, learn about how government works, do the state's business, interact with lots of powerful people across the strait without having to spell out clear political positions on many issues. So
although
in that case, it's interesting.
It seems like it's increasingly becoming a springboard. You know, you've got Van Ostern and you've got Sununu. Chris Pappas is on the council. He's someone who was for a while being pushed to run for that Democratic nomination for the first congressional district. And we're seeing two state senators, Sam Cataldo, Russell Prescott, leaving the Senate to go run for the executive council. So in an odd way, it has become this sort of increasingly seen as a springboard. And I will be interested, as you say, Kathleen, to see is there going to be a little bit more grandstanding at the next couple of meetings, given where we are in the electoral calendar?
All right. Why don't we move to another big race on Tuesday night, and that would be the Congressional District 1 primary between incumbent Frank Ginta and challenger Rich Ashew. That one turned out to be even a closer finish than the governor's race. Rich Ashew conceded, I think the margin was 600 or 700 votes in the district. You know, I think it's fair to say that Frank Ginta has demonstrated he's something of a survivor at this point. I mean, he was obviously called on, his resignation was called for by top members of his party, including Senator Kelly Ayotte, leaders at the State House. You know, I have to say, I thought Ginta would end up surviving. I wouldn't have predicted that a year ago. It was pretty close. You know, what do you think made the difference for him, Casey?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I think, you know, if you had asked most people who were following politics this time a year ago, they would have said that he probably wouldn't stand a chance. But, you know, if you look at how he's approached the last year, I think that he has really tried to do everything he can to kind of push those campaign finance issues aside when he's asked about it. And he's also tried to kind of play up his, you know, constituent work. So, you know, saying, I'm doing all of this for you guys, here's what I can deliver. And I think that definitely would have played into maybe his ability to hang on a little bit here.
Okay, we'll continue to paw over the results out of the first congressional district primary after the break. Do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We'll be back with more of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute. New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@NHPR or via Facebook or Twitter. Okay, so we were talking about the first congressional district primary, a nail biter conceded Wednesday morning by Rich Ashew. Dean, you know, Frank Ginta, you know, he ran as he's an incumbent. He ran as the outsider. He was found in violation of illegal receipt of $355,000 from his parents. He was able to put Rich Ashew on the defensive, you know, on sort of on moral grounds of the fact that Ashew was a registered lobbyist for BAE Systems, which is, you know, one of New Hampshire's largest employers. You know, what do we make of Ginta's success? Is it that people don't care about the FEC violation? Is it that he has a name recognition edge? Is it a little of both? Is it something about the current makeup of the Republican Party?
I think it's probably all those things in some measure. You know, this was a very close race, 700 votes. And I was talking yesterday to someone who was a strong Ashew supporter, and that individual was telling me that he felt like it just took Ashew longer to kind of get the campaign up and running and focused than would have been ideal, that they had this outside pack that wasn't quite as effective as it was supposed to be. I agree he was very defensive on the lobbyist issue. So it just took him a while to kind of hit his stride. I mean, that said, it's a very close race. You know, Frank Ginta, you know, a number of us have suggested that his political skills are underrated, that he really just kind of kept his nose to the grindstone here month after month out there telling people here's what he's done for the state. He's also kind of good at reading the political environment. You know, he's been a strong and early embracer of Donald Trump. And kind of able to use that energy much in the same way he did in 2010, where he was, quote, a Tea Party freshman. So he's good at kind of sort of surfing the political environment in a given moment. I think he was the only sort of major person at the Trump rally last night in Laconia, and that's happened a couple times. So I think he was very smart about that. And part of it is also, I think maybe the FEC stuff is either kind of lost on people or, you know, it's from 2010, it's sort of old news. But, you know, all this is going to come back up in the general. I think Carol Shaport and the Democrats are just sort of waiting to hash this stuff over all over again.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Carol Shaporter said yesterday? This actually was from the Democrats' Unity Breakfast, by the way. This is Shaporter addressing supporters and Democrats at the Puritan Backroom in Manchester yesterday morning.
We already know Frank Ginta, so I really don't need to talk very much about him except to say one thing. He's pretty much against everything we stand for. And so, again, I agree with what his opponent said. I absolutely agree with what Senator Ayotte said. He should resign, but he hasn't. So we will push him out of office.
That was Carol Shaporter at the Unity Breakfast for Democrats at the Puritan Back Room yesterday. Obviously, she, you know, this is their fourth go-around, and, you know, brace yourself. These folks know each other well. It's obvious for anyone who's ever moderated a debate where they've been participating, they don't like each other terribly much. And, you know, it's interesting whether or not who's a swing voter in the Ginta-Shaporter race. That's something that, like, you know, you could spend a lot of time thinking about. But you can feel that regardless of whether or not, you know, voters in the Republican primary cared about this FEC business. And you can argue that this is a story that was more about the cover-up than the so-called crime. I mean, this was money from his family. It was in violation of the law. But a lot of voters I talked to were kind of like, well, you know, it wasn't like his parents were trying to buy influence. This was a long time ago. You know, to hear Frank Ginta to talk after the Unity Breakfast, he believes, you know, this thing is totally behind him. Why don't we take a listen to what he said on this score from Wednesday morning?
I'm looking forward. We're focusing on public policy issues. People have spoken, and I'm going to continue to focus on the policies that I think people care about.
All right. So that was Frank Ginta Wednesday morning. The people have spoken as far as the FEC goes, and he considers it a settled matter. You know, Kathleen, you were at that breakfast talking to Republicans. Did you get the sense that you know, a divisive primary, that everyone's now going to be pointed in the same direction for Frank Ginta?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that they just dislike Carol Shaporter, you know, so much. I don't know that, you know, Ashew's backers are really going to I don't see a lot of people really, like, you know, lining up and, like, fighting super hard for Frank Inta. I think that some Republicans certainly will. The people that, you know, went with Ashew, I don't know that they will be huge supporters of him. But I think in general, you know, the Republican Party is going to get behind him. I think the fact that he was able to get through his primary, you know, says something about, you know, kind of his work ethic and certainly not taking the primary for granted. I think it is amazing that voters in New Hampshire hate Congress so much, want term limits, all this stuff. And here we have the same race happening for a fourth time. Carol Shea Porter has been running for office for a decade now. Frank Inta has been running since 2010. I think that voters on the whole just don't really care that much about who represents them in Congress from this district, because there's not really been an effort to kind of change who their candidates are.
Well, some of the emails that came out in the hacked hacking of the Democratic National Committee was interesting. There
wanted,
was internal
wanted Chris Pat. I mean, the party. Yeah. Yes, the party certainly. I think the party, it seems, maybe wanted a change. Voters as a whole, though, I just don't. I don't think they really care that much about.
But some of these hacked emails released by so-called Guccifer, I don't know how are you supposed to say that. I don't know. I've never heard it pronounced. But showed that there was, you know, discussion among party officials about, you know, it'd be nice if Chris Pappas could run and not so much Carol Shea Porter. Obviously, Carol Shea Porter has proven herself to be pretty good at rallying Democrats when she needs to. One wrinkle that was added to this race yesterday was a decision by the Ballot Law Commission to allow Sean O'Connor on the ballot. He was planning to run as a Democrat, had friction with party leaders, claimed that Carol Shea Porter and her supporters were defaming him, sort of rumor-mongering, threatened to sue. Democrats then tried to block him getting on the ballot because you need to turn in 1,500 verified petitions. They claim that some of these were improper. It gets very technical. The bottom line is the Ballot Law Commission voted 4-1 yesterday that Sean O'Connor can get on the ballot as an independent. You know, Frank had apparently mentioned O'Connor on stage last night in Laconia. Democrats didn't want him on the ballot for the idea that he might siphon votes from Shea Porter. Do you think there's any indication that could be the case?
It's really a big question mark right now. I want to see a little bit more of what O'Connor does as an independent candidate. He's able to self-fund. He's a successful businessman. That was a sort of an odd and vitriolic back and forth between him and Shea Porter and the Democratic Party when it occurred. But I'm sure they're concerned. If this ends up being a really close race and he takes even a couple percentage points as a pushing himself forward as a progressive, that could hurt him. But I don't really have a sense yet of what how serious a candidate he's going to be. The other interesting thing will be to see the extent to which the National Party apparatus in both parties directs money into this race. Do they, do Republicans see this as, Ginta could hang on and they need to keep the seat, or are they just going to kind of leave him out there because they think he's damaged goods? Shea Porter, we know from those memos, Democratic Party was not thrilled about having her, but now they've sort of decided to get behind her. So, of the two congressional districts, in theory, this could be the district where a lot of money comes in, but maybe not given how the parties feel about the candidates. We'll see.
Well, why don't we try to call? We've got a call on this issue right now on the line. Why don't we? Okay, I guess that call is gone. But in any case, O'Connor, I am curious to know whether or not he can marshal any support. It was unclear that he had any to begin with. The fact that he could self-fund is something that might give pause to some Democrats. I mean, it was interesting at the Ballot Law Commission hearing. I ducked my head in there briefly yesterday. And, O'Connor has his lawyer. The Democratic Party, has its lawyer. It has, former party chair Kathy Sullivan sitting in the hall outside the event, outside the hearing, along with, other interested Democrats. They say the rules are the rules, and they don't believe that O'Connor met the test of the statute. The Ballot Law Commission chair Brad Cook said that the statute is unclear on, the remedy for this specific issue. And so, we'll see where this goes, but the Ballot Law Commission is the final word. O'Connor will be on the ballot. And, there was some speculation on Twitter last night from Kevin Landringer, the union leader. He was attending the Trump rally, that when O'Connor was mentioned by Ginta that you know, he was anticipating that we can expect Franken to make a push to have Sean O'Connor in the debates, which would add a fresh angle from the viewer's point of view, but that could not be something that Shea Porter would want.
Yeah, I think even yesterday, you know, after the Unity breakfast, I talked to Frank Ginta a couple times, and he said Sean O'Connor's name whenever possible. I think that he's going to do what he can to, you know, try and remind Democratic voters that, you know, they in theory have a choice here about this race. And I think that he's really going to be trying to push that. O'Connor has yet to really articulate a message or do much to get his name out there beyond feuding with the Democratic Party.
Well, he had part of his feud with the party, you know, he would say came out of his support for Bernie Sanders in the primary, and, you know, not to get too in the weeds, there was some fight over whether or not O'Connor was going to be allowed to introduce him in an event. It gets very petty, but O'Connor was initially, I'm a Bernie Sanders progressive. He has a background that suggests that a lot of Democrats say is a sort of a more centrist one. He's now running as an independent. It'll be interesting how he does out there as a candidate, because no one's ever seen it. Everyone knows he's moved here a few years ago. He's got a lot of money and, you know, is ambitious.
Yeah, I think the key for him, he needs to articulate a message and he needs to do it very fast, or he's just going to completely get lost in this race.
All right, let's move to a race that has been getting a lot of attention forever, the U.S. Senate race and the results in there. Obviously, everyone's expecting incumbent Kellyanne to win. She did win handily. Jim Rubin's got 19% of the vote. No one gave that race much attention, but is there anything that we can glean from the results there, or is it just, you know, anyone's going to be able to get 19 or 20% against an incumbent, Dean?
Yeah, I'm not reading too much into these results. My sense is that the party will generally rally around Kelly Ayotte. I had a chance to do an extended interview with her on Election Day, and you can find that link to that on my website at NH Political Capital. She made very clear that she is kind of wedded to a strategy that focuses on bipartisanship, reaching across the aisle. She went out of her way to mention examples in the Senate where she had worked with Democrats on issues like Joe Manchin, for example, from West Virginia. And so this is kind of her strategy, and it really, I think that potentially, you know, there'd be members of both parties who are going to try to link the Senate race to Trump and Clinton. But I think both she and Maggie Hass are going to work very hard to make this about New Hampshire, to make it about bipartisanship. I think it's going to feel like a very traditional statewide New Hampshire race, a different dynamic than what we're seeing at the national race. And both of them, Hassan and Ayotte, each in their own way, has to deal with potential complications from the top of the ticket. They both get asked about their party's nominees on a regular basis to try to sort of pin them down. And I think they're both going to be working hard not to get pinned down. But, you know, Jim Rubens, we know pretty well at this point. He sort of fed into the idea that conservatives were not happy with Ayotte, although I don't think he was sort of the ideal conservative candidate for a lot of these folks. There is, I believe, Aaron Day is running as an independent. I think that's still going forward, although I'm not 100% sure. So there might be an option there. But no, I think this is a very comfortable win for her. She seemed very relaxed on Tuesday and not particularly concerned about Rubens.
So, Kathleen, I saw Aaron Day in the parking lot of the GOP Unity Breakfast. I did not see him inside the room. Have you heard anything? I mean, that was whether or not there was going to be, you know, independent campaign against. I mean, is he on the ballot?
To be honest,
I think he is. I'm not sure.
I don't think that I've heard much
lately,
from
have,
him
yeah.
as far as yeah. what, you know, that candidacy looks like. I will say that it surprised me, and, you know, I don't want to necessarily read too much into it, but I think it was maybe 3 weeks ago or so, Andrew Hemingway wrote an op-ed in the Union Leader getting behind Kelly Ayotte, and that was something that kind of, you know, made my eyebrows go up and say, maybe she doesn't have as big of a problem with her base as I thought she did. And, you know, Andrew Hemingway, of course, ran for governor in 2014, kind of a conservative mischief maker. You know, he was with Ted Cruz. Now he's with Donald Trump. But, you know, he wrote this op-ed basically saying, I think in part it said, you know, I haven't always been happy with Kelly, but we need a Republican. And she, you know, she's a Republican. This is who we need. I haven't spoken to Andrew to see kind of what that means, but that said something to me. And I just haven't really heard a whole lot from Aaron Day, there certainly hasn't been, you know, much outreach to media as to what he is doing.
Seems less now than it was a few months ago, from my recollection from social media.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
More in the room, I mean, you know, the room at the GOP Unity Breakfast is not necessarily reflective of the electorate. And, you know, there'd be a lot of conservatives who might not be there. But, you know, Kelly Ayotte, obviously, she, you know, she went over pretty well in there. I mean, I thought it was interesting that she – that, you know, as you move into the general election, that she was, you know, made a big point of saying, you know, she, former Governor Craig Benson was there, of course, gave her a, her start in some sense. She'd been at the Attorney General's office. She was his counsel as governor. Then, you know, he ended up appointing her to Attorney General, which was reappointed by John Lynch, and, you know, the rest is history. You know, she made a big point of praising him, which, you know, obviously he was a controversial figure. It's been a while since he's been in office. But to start the general election saying, you know, it's a room full of Republicans, you know, remember, I wouldn't be here without him. You know, I thought it was interesting.
Is interesting because in my interview, her touchstone mentions were Warren Rudman and Judd Gregg. And so it's very different to then mention Craig Benson.
So, you know, obviously a lot of attention, a lot of money spent on this race. You know, we'll be going at it. And I guess it'll determine, I mean, you know, to hear the campaigns talk, it's going to be about who do voters believe is the most bipartisan candidate. That's seemingly what both Hafson and Ayotte are going for.
Yeah. And I think at least at the top of the ticket, we're starting to hear everybody really craft this election as, you know, this binary choice, right? Chris Christie did it. I don't care if you don't like Donald Trump. It's either Trump or Clinton. You have to pick one. And I think why we might start to see some conservatives get a little bit more behind Ayotte is that kind of messaging that, listen, it's either Ayotte or Hassan. There is no other choice. And Hassan, you know, they're going to be painting her as, you know, this liberal ally of Hillary Clinton. And so I think that might help her shore up her
base. Christie even went a step further and said, if you don't vote for Trump, Kelly Ayotte will lose. So making
I thought it was
clear
very
link there, yeah.
His speech, I thought, was very, very interesting. It was not just a, you know, vote for Donald Trump. It was throw your weight behind Donald Trump or you are a bad Republican. And Kelly Ayotte was no longer in the room when that speech was happening, but I wonder how exactly she would react. And I actually went up to Chris Christie after and I asked him, I said, you know, you were very stern about the way the Republicans have to act around Trump. And do you think that Senator Ayotte has done enough to get behind him? And he said something along the lines of, you know, Kelly supports Donald Trump. I don't think there's any ambiguity in that. So I don't know. It was hard to I didn't know if he was trying to, like, you know, like apply this pressure that she better get in line or like I don't really know what it was. Yeah. But it was a very aggressive speech.
Well, he
from
said
Chris Christie.
He also said he mentioned, you know, I haven't been traveling politically. I've been helping Donald Trump get ready to make sure he can serve. And then he said, you know, and Donald Trump's coming to Laconia. And, you know, I want everyone in this room to be there. And if everyone can't be there, then, like, be there in spirit. It's not his exact words, but that's what he said. But he said, I want everyone to be there. And, you know, based on the reporting I've seen out of last night, I wasn't there. You know, a lot of those people weren't there. And typically at this time in election season, when a presidential candidate comes to town, it's like, and here's so-and-so, and here's the other person, and we're running as a team. And obviously Donald Trump is a different kind of candidate. And so, you know, factor that in. But, you know, Kelly Ayotte was not there. My understanding is that, you know, she said she had obligations due to the death of her husband's father, her father-in-law. You know, she has been campaigning. Frank Ginta was there. You know, Chris Sununu has campaigned with Trump. You know, I guess this will remain something that people think about. Whether voters care, you know, is an open question. I mean, you know, obviously the fact that Donald Trump is doing things in a way that isn't conventional shouldn't be shocking at this point. And so, you know, we'll see. I do think Chris Christie's pressure to, you know, be of one mind regarding Trump and the ticket is something that, you know, was interesting. We'll see where it goes. So come back in a minute. We'll be more on the top New Hampshire headlines in our weekly news roundup. We're going over the primary and looking towards November. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. Do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. What did you think of the results on Tuesday? And what are you looking towards if we get to November in any of these races? And I want to return to a comment Dean made about the way in which campaigns are talking about, candidates and campaigns are talking about November as being a binary choice. You pick one party or the other. And I want to play a little tape from union leader publisher Joe McQuaid this week, who took to the editorial page with a different view in the paper's endorsement of the Libertarian ticket of Gary Johnson and Bill Weld.
A lot of people have said that it's a so-called binary choice, and you have to pick one of these two, and one is supposedly the lesser of two evils, Clinton and Trump. And we don't think that is so, and the Libertarians have managed to get their candidates on the ballots in all 50 states, and we think they are the better choice.
All right. That was union leader publisher Joe McQuaid on why his paper is endorsing Gary Johnson and Bill Weld for president. So, Dean, obviously you've read many union leader editorial for a long time. How significant is this?
It's really interesting. It got a lot of national attention. I think this is the first time in 100 years that they haven't endorsed a Republican for president, which is just fascinating. I got to tell you, I get emails from friends and acquaintances all around the country, and they usually say something like, God, I just can't bring myself to vote for Trump. I really don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. What about Gary Johnson, or what about Jill Stein? They're almost looking for permission to vote for one of these other candidates. So I direct them now to the union leader editorial, and they can decide for themselves. It is true. I think Gary Johnson, if he can get into the debates, which I'm not super optimistic for him that it's going to happen. I think they set a 15% threshold, and he's just not quite there. I think that would help him. I think a lot of people don't really know all that much about him. I interviewed him back in 2012 when he ran for the GOP nomination, and he basically became disenchanted with the party, felt like he was being kind of blocked from any real visibility by some of the major cable networks. And so he ran for the third party nomination then. So, we'll see. I think he's become, to some extent, Jill Stein as well, sort of an all-purpose vessel for people who are unhappy with this concept of a binary choice. But there's no doubt, as I was saying, and you and Kathleen as well, the major parties want this to be a binary choice. As McQuaid said, you hold your nose and you vote for the one candidate, otherwise the other candidate wins. And he's pushing back against that. And I think, like I said, at least anecdotally, I hear from people all the time who are looking for some other option.
Kathleen?
Yeah, speaking of Chris Christie, who the union leader endorsed in the primary, which obviously did not help much, he also, in his speech at the Unity Breakfast, said very clearly that, a vote Gary Johnson, it's not happening, folks. Like, do not, third parties, they never win, don't do it. Was just kind of like made a big joke of it all, right? But I think, it is interesting to see the union leader go with Gary Johnson. I think, these days, do newspaper endorsements really matter? I don't know that we've seen that they have in New Hampshire, but certainly interesting to see this major, conservative paper come out and say, we're not getting behind the Republican nominee. And we've seen that across the country. I believe the Dallas Morning News endorsed Clinton, and I think it was the first Democrat, they'd either ever endorsed or in 100 years or something like that. So we're seeing, conservative editorial boards across the country standing up and saying, we're not going to go with this guy. And whether or not that actually sways voters, I think it says something about the way that, some Republicans feel about Trump.
Well, and the way Trump ran his race. I mean, obviously, it's not surprising that given the back and forth that Trump and Joe McQuaid engaged in during the primary, that the union leader would not endorse him. In some ways, despite the history of them endorsing the Republican, this is a potential unique situation. But I do think it also shows the potential disconnect between, people, you could call them insiders or people who've been close to traditional politics for a long time, and, voters who are out there in the real world and their comfort for things and their lack of understanding of why, there's expectations that candidates act in a traditional manner. I mean, I think that this election is going to be interesting for that reason, to see, how that pans out. So, Casey, did you have...
Getting back to the idea that the union leader did endorse Christie,
Aaron Day.
A few months later, they kind of issued this editorial like, boy, were we wrong. So they did rescind that. I do think it's interesting, too, just the idea of how much do endorsements really matter. A host on NHPR asked Joe McQuaid about that yesterday. And his argument was, you know, will this, you know, really significantly influence the election? He's not sure. But his hope was that, you know, just because of all of the buzz the endorsement was getting, that maybe, you know, that would give Johnson some more kind of exposure on the national level. There's a lot of national media attention around this. So whether it'll change any hearts and minds is another thing, but it might give him a little bit of a boost that would be, you know, useful for him in terms of maybe getting on a debate stage or something else.
Okay, let's go to the call. We have Aaron Day on the line. We were discussing his potential Senate campaign earlier. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's just be clear. Are you running for Senate, and are you planning to actively campaign?
I am running for Senate. I am absolutely planning on actively campaigning, and I was waiting to see the outcome of the Republican primary, and to see if for instance, Jim Rubin's defeated Kelly Ayotte. Now that that's not the case, I will be actively campaigning, and I've run a super PAC. In fact, I ran two statewide races in 2014, raised over $300,000. So I will be running a complete campaign, but was waiting for the appropriate timing to begin.
Okay, so I saw you in the parking lot of the Unity breakfast. You know, what were you doing, and like, how was? Were you telling people that this was your plan?
What was I doing at the Unity breakfast? Well, of course, I mean, I've supported a number of the people. I was, you know, previously involved heavily in Republican politics, and I certainly know most of the people at the Unity breakfast. And I assume that the fact that they held the Unity breakfast in Bedford the day after the primary, a quarter of a mile down the road from my house, and that they rejected having Jim Rubin show up at the Unity breakfast, and said he couldn't show up and that he'd be turned away if he showed up, I figured, you know what, I'm just going to go there because I think I know what all of that's about. So I just figured I'd just stop by and say hi to people.
Okay, that's interesting. I would have to check on that. I mean, are you sure, was he asking to speak? Or I would imagine he'd be welcome, but I mean, we can look into that.
I don't think he was asking to speak. I think he was planning on attending and was told not to attend and that he'd be turned away if he attended. And you know what, to be honest, it's a Unity breakfast. So when in a Unity breakfast context, you're turning away a candidate for U.S. Senate, it's just another example of the extent to which the NHGOP will hypocritically go back and talk about unity and everything else. But when it all comes down to it, it's all about protecting their incumbent darling, Kelly Ayotte.
All right, Aaron, see you on the campaign trail. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right, Aaron Day, a candidate for U.S. Senate. We'll check on the claim about Jim Rubin's, Kathleen.
Yeah, so Jim Rubin's campaign did put out a statement saying that they were denied tickets to the Unity breakfast. So this is something that I'm looking at it right now. They said that they wanted to go and publicly support Kelly Ayotte. Unfortunately, the Rubin's campaign was denied tickets. And he said, I will keep the promise I made on the first day of my campaign that I will support and endorse the Republican nominee. I therefore urge my 20,000 supporters to do likewise and work to elect Kelly Ayotte. So I'm going to have to check in with the Republican Party on that. Ayotte at the Unity breakfast did thank – several people were thanking Jim Rubins. And Ayotte, you know, thanked him for the primary. I did not realize that he wasn't there. And so I'm, you know, interested to kind of check in and, you know – ask the Republican Party what this is all about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I had not heard that either. I didn't sense there was any particular animosity between Rubens and Ayotte. They had a couple of spirited debates, but sort of well within kind of what you would typically expect for a primary. So that is interesting.
All right. Why don't we turn to presidential politics of the vice presidential sort? Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, on behalf of Hillary Clinton, was here yesterday. He's been here three times, twice in the last month. He was in Exeter and Portsmouth and, talking up policy issues. Kathleen, why do you think Tim Kaine's been here so often? Just easy to get to, important state?
Yeah, well, so I actually have spent a little bit of time in Kaine's traveling press corps. And the last time that he was here, he was not supposed to be here. He was supposed to go to Florida, but there was a hurricane and his wife, Anne, was already campaigning here. And so we ended up diverting and actually did a completely packed day here in New Hampshire. I think that, you know, they see New Hampshire as a state that they definitely – I think Clinton has a little bit of an edge here, but it's not something that they want to take for granted, our four electoral votes. And I think that, you know, Tim Kaine's a pretty good messenger for the ticket. I think that what we've seen him doing pretty consistently is, you know, going after Donald Trump and drawing some significant contrasts, you know, on a public policy basis. I think that he overall, you know, comes across well. He's not a guy who, you know, creates a lot of attention or controversy. But I think that, you know, if she is maybe focused on other states with a little bit more aggressive attention, you know, he's a good, obviously a good surrogate to send here. And they certainly don't want to take New Hampshire for granted.
Yeah. Well, when Kane was here during the trip, when his wife, who was the Secretary of Education in Virginia, was here, and they were at the community college, and they appeared with Governor Lynch and Susan Lynch, and you know, I know you'll recall, Kathleen, when Susan Lynch and talked about wanting to win and dance at the White House. Susan Lynch tap dances. Ann Holton, Tim Kaine's wife, apparently clogs in an Appalachian manner. You know, I talked to Governor Lynch afterwards, and he was talking about how, you know, he really, you know, had nothing but, you know, incredibly positive things to say about Tim Kaine, that he was one of his favorite governors, that he was urging Tim Kaine to be up here a lot. And you can see Tim Kaine on the campaign trail. I mean, in some ways, it is sort of John Lynch-like and, you know, perhaps a little bit more aggressive campaigner, but it is, you know, he's very positive. He's appears to be genuinely interested in talking to people and, you know, at ease talking about policy and, you know, not at all divisive. I mean, it's not somebody, you're not going to come away from an event saying like, God, you know, I can't stand that guy. Like, you know, and so, you know, you can see why he's an effective surrogate, particularly given that Hillary Clinton, you know, can be polarizing still, even within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and it was just speaking how he seems to be someone who genuinely likes to talk policy. I noticed that when he was here last time, he did this phone banking event in Nashua, and he was calling some volunteers, and I was standing right next to him. Some volunteer kept him on the phone for like 8 minutes, and he's scribbling all these notes, and I'm like, what are they talking about? And he's just silent as this voter's talking his ear off. And then he goes up to one of his aides and is like, they want to ask about pension reform. We need to follow up with this person. We need to do this. And it was very like, you know, this wasn't like a media show. Like, this was something he genuinely like wanted to follow up with someone on. So I think that he has that kind of wonkishness about him. And I agree, you know, he's not someone that people tend to, you know, walk away from it. He's not polarizing. He's also not incredibly, I think he's just kind of vanilla. And that's sometimes what you want out of your vice presidential candidate. Someone who's not going to make waves, someone who's not going to steal the spotlight too much. Someone who's just going to be kind of a loyal surrogate for you.
It's interesting to me the extent to which New Hampshire seems to be back in play now. It was just a few weeks ago where I think the WMUR poll had Hillary Clinton up by 11 points. There's a lot of polling now that suggests that it's more likely just a few points separating them. For a long time, all of the Electoral College projections that I've seen, where you obviously need 270 to win the presidency, Hillary Clinton was well over 300, 310, 320. On up. Now, with a sort of tightening of the polls, Trump appearing to gain his footing a little bit, I'm seeing a number of projections where Trump could conceivably be in, you know, the 266 range, 260, and then those four electoral votes become very important again. So it's not surprising to me that the Clinton folks are sending Kaine up here, that Donald Trump came back in yesterday and did the rally at the Laconia Middle School. It feels like we are in play at the moment, and so I think we're going to see a lot of these candidates and the surrogates until such time that the polls widen again one way or the other.
All right. I think we're going to leave politics there for now. We'll be back at it shortly, of course. You know, as we wrap up here today, you know, NHPR, The Exchange, and myself personally just wanted to make note of the death of Mark Hanley. He was a longtime general manager here, helped, you know, bring the station to what it is today. Why don't we hear something he said some years ago about what he saw as the future of New Hampshire Public Radio?
When I came here, I wasn't sure what this station should become. And I thought that this was going to be more of a classical music station than anything else. And it was through a period, it took me about 5 years of making some mistakes, learning to listen really well, and hearing what the people of the state were saying they wanted and they needed before we really began to focus on the news and information, which is where people were loud and clearly saying, this is your strength, this is what we need, won't you do more of it?
All right, that was Mark Hanley, longtime general manager and president of New Hampshire Public Radio, who died this week. You know, Mark Hanley ran the station when I was hired. Couldn't say enough about how kind and thoughtful, you know, a quiet leader, never meddled in anything in the news department, but was certainly always there, you know, should anyone need support or help. And, you know, it's true that New Hampshire Public Radio would not really be here today in its present form without all the good things he did. So, you know, best to Mark Hanley's family, and, you know, he'll surely be remembered and missed by all who knew him. So on to next week. What are we going to be following, Kathleen?
I mean, I think that I'll be, you know, paying attention to some of the ramifications of the primary, how the general election starts shaping up, particularly in the race between Chris Sununu and Colin Van Oostern. You know, we've got, I think, 7 short weeks till the general election, so things are going to get very aggressive, very fast. And then I'll also be doing some traveling with Tim Kaine in the coming weeks as well.
So, Casey, what are you going to be looking at?
So I'm actually going to be taking a closer look at the Executive Council, just given its kind of rising prominence in state politics. I just started kind of going through yesterday, looking at who has actually been on the Executive Council, just to kind of return to what we were talking about earlier. And if you actually look at it, it's a lot of the same names over and over again, a lot of kind of politicians who may have gone there, stayed there, wrote out the, you know, maybe end of their public service careers. And I think we're definitely seeing kind of a shifting dynamic there. So I'll be interested in kind of exploring that a little bit more.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that it was sort of more of an out to pasture position than it appears to be now. Dean, what are you going to be following?
Very similar. Going to be looking at all the campaigns and seeing how they transition to a general election strategy, kind of seeing how the organizations gear up and the extent to which the two parties kind of fall in line behind their chosen nominees.
Those will be big questions in the coming weeks. Thank you for joining us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.